You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 7th, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
October 7, 1952, the first patent for the barcode was issued to inventors Joseph Woodland and Bernard Silver.
That explains Google.
That's why Google had the barcode. Okay.
Thank you. Yes.
Excellent. Cool.
Everyone listening to this show, I'm sure, used Google at some point today and saw the barcode. I went a step further and figured out why the barcode.
By clicking on the logo.
Now, here's what a podcast would sound like if it were a barcode. Big line, little line, little line, little line, big line, little line, little line, big line, big line, little line.
Podcast in binary.
Are we going to talk about this? Because I actually know a shitload of stuff about barcodes.
Anything interesting?
Yeah, make it compelling, Jay.
How about this? The first barcode was not in straight lines. What were the shapes of the quote-unquote bars?
Wavy lines?
Circles.
Really? Circles?
A series of concentric circles.
I can tell you that...
Yes.
Made like a bullseye.
Excellent. Yeah,
sort
yeah,
of symbol.
Yeah.
The number 666 does not appear before every barcode. It's just
right.
the bracketing.
Just special ones.
It's the bracketing code. It's not the number 666.
But don't be fooled. Barcodes still are instrumental in Armageddon.
Oh, yeah. Still the mark of the beast. Absolutely.
No doubt.
You know, if I was going to get a tattoo, I always say I would get a tattoo of a barcode on the bottom of my foot.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
That's kind of silly because the barcode would be perfectly meaningless. It wouldn't be like you actually have your barcode.
I would do it just for the humor, Jay.
Okay.
Just for the coroner who does your autopsy, so he gets a big laugh?
Yep. That's right.
One quick and sad update from last week. We talked about Premanand, the Indian James Randi, and how he was sick with cancer and on his deathbed put out a proclamation saying, "No deathbed conversions for me, basically. I remained dedicated to rationalism to the end." And we did hear the news that he did pass away since the last episode, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, but, October 4th, yeah.
Yeah, he lived a full and fulfilling life by all accounts, so...
I have another update from the last show, actually.
Okay.
I'm on this show now.
Yes.
And it's 2 in the morning.
That's right.
That's right.
Rebecca is in London. It's 2
like
in the morning there. And,
in case listeners were wondering why I'm whispering.
And why she sounds half comatose, right?
It's not just because I have a sore throat from Tam London, which I do, but also because, it's 2 in the morning.
But Rebecca, can't you just go in the other room?
There is no other room.
Oh. A one-room flat.
But how was Tam London?
Tam London was remarkable, or amazing, if you will. It was a huge success. The speakers were fantastic, and everything went off without a hitch. I managed to record a number of interviews with different speakers and even guests at Tam London, and we'll have some audio of those on the show, both on this episode and more coming up later. But it was a lot of fun. 2 thumbs up.
Excellent. Awesome. Sounds like they're going to be doing this again in the future, right? This is not going to be an isolated event.
They pretty much have to at this point, I think, because it was this Tam London sold out in something like 50 minutes.
Yeah.
So
it was fast.
I think that a response like that demands a Tam London part 2.
Even bigger and better, hopefully.
Yeah. Hopefully, yeah.
Bigger venue.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, if enough of our UK listeners want to bring us out there, maybe the SGU will show up next year.
Yeah.
Maybe.
That would be awesome.
You never know. Well, it is that time of year again for the Nobel Prizes, and a few have already been announced. The Nobel Prize for Medicine was given to 3 individuals, Elizabeth Blackburn, Carol Greeter, and Jack Sostak. Might be Sostak, I'm not sure.
Seth.
S-Z, what do you think? S-Z-O-S-T-A-K?
Yeah, yeah.
Sostak?
Sostak, yeah.
For...
No.
Jack.
Jack.
Not so, Jack.
His older brother.
For the discovery of how chromosomes are protected by telomeres and the enzyme telomerase. So, you know, these are like these basic aspects of biology that I learned in college and medical school. So, you know, it's always interesting to hear, you know, it's like decades later they get the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
Something that's, you know, it's, I've always took for granted. It's interesting. But absolutely, I mean, the telomeres are now a fundamental part of our understanding of chromosomes. So, again, the DNA, the genetic material in each one of our cells is divided up into different chromosomes.
They're like end caps, right? They're like little protective end caps.
In fact, I think Elizabeth Blackburn used the analogy, they're like the little tabs at the end of shoelaces, right? They keep they keep it from unwinding. But also, when a chromosome gets copied, the process can't copy the very end of the chromosome. The very end of the chromosome gets left off. So if there were genes, coding genes, all the way to the end, every time it got copied, a little bit of important genetic information would get left off. For a while, that was considered to be like the chromosome problem. You know, what is the solution to this? The discovery of telomeres solved this problem because there's essentially this non-coding repetitive DNA cap at the end of each chromosome. And when the chromosome gets copied, a little bit of the telomere gets left off. But that's okay because it's just this filler cap at the end anyway. Now, telomerase actually expands the telomere. So the telomere gets, you lose a little bit when it gets copied, but it can be reproduced. You know, you can build back some of the telomere with telomerase. So the understanding of telomeres also was instrumental in understanding how some cancers work. Some cell lines become immortal. They don't stop growing, and that's essentially, you know, one of the features of cancer. Critical basic science understanding of how our chromosomes work and many applications in terms of medicine. So not surprising that they earned a Nobel Prize. You guys know how much the Nobel Prize award is up to?
Yeah, almost to $1.5 million, yeah, 1.4.
1.4
million. Nice.
I didn't know that they gave money with that.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. Nice chuckle.
I thought it was just bragging rights.
Which is pretty kick-ass as it is, but oh my God, 1.5 million?
1.4, yeah.
1.4.
Did they give any Nobel Prizes out for podcasts?
Not yet, but hey.
That's right. The next award that won Nobel Prize in Chemistry 2009 was given, one of the three people is from Yale University.
Yay. Do you know him?
Right. No.
You do now.
I do now. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was given to, again, three people: Venkatraman Ramakrishnan, Thomas Stietz, and Ada Yonath, for understanding the structure and function of the ribosome. So even though this is chemistry, it's really biochemistry. And the ribosome is an organelle. It's a structure inside pretty much every living cell. What ribosomes do is they translate RNA. So, you know, first DNA gets transcribed into various forms of RNA. RNA is like the set of instructions that runs through the ribosome, and the ribosome will build a protein based upon the instructions in the RNA. So that's what the ribosome does. It's the protein factory.
Kind of important.
Kind of important, yeah. I mean, basically the biochemical factory that builds life, right?
It's a little nanomachine.
Yeah, right. It's a little important. It's central to our understanding of biology, really, the ribosome. Again, numerous applications. Interestingly, the one application that I've in all the news reports, probably because it was in the press release, that people mention is some antibiotics function by targeting bacterial ribosomes, and which are different than eukaryotic ribosomes, right? So they're different than the host cells. So we can stop bacteria from reproducing by stopping their ribosomes from functioning. So some antibiotics function that way. Again, certainly sounds worthy of a Nobel Prize to me.
Steve, there's a Howard Hughes Medical Institute at Yale.
Oh yeah. If you have millions, billions of dollars, you have lots of stuff named after you.
Well, he was very into medical research. That's why he kept all those jars of his own urine.
Yeah, and wore tissue boxes on his feet. Never clipped his nails.
Simpsons, yes. Awesome episode.
Now, seriously, you know, Howard Hughes had mental illness, so we really shouldn't make fun of somebody's mental illness. A very tragic story. The guy was...
We're making fun of the symptoms.
Yes. It was.
But seriously, we can, but because it's pop culture.
And he's
but
dead.
It's been long enough.
I do want to mention that Howard Hughes was, a very successful, brilliant, you know, man whose life was really tragically altered by mental illness. And that's part of the reason why it really bugs me when people are like mental illness deniers. They say that like psychiatric diseases don't really exist. It's, the course of this guy's life was significantly altered by mental illness, as with a lot of people. So I just wanted to point that out.
And he probably today he probably couldn't have been fixed by one pill a day or something.
Yeah, that's the other thing. He might have just been on the right medication. He could have had a completely different outcome.
I wonder if it played into his inspiration for all the things he accomplished in his life, though. At all, you know, I mean, how if you took that aspect out, what else would have been different? Would have changed?
That's a very good point.
But
it's a good point. And there, in fact, was a recent study which showed that brilliance and insanity, if you will, can go hand in hand in certain individuals. And Bob, you're going to tell us about the Nobel Prize in Physics for 2009.
Yeah, congratulations to Charles Coe, Willard Boyle, and George Smith. Like some of Steve's science or fiction segments, this year's Nobel Prize for Physics had a theme like light technology. When Gunnar Okquist, who's the Academy's Secretary General, when he announced the winners recently, he said that the work of the physics winners has built the foundation to our modern information society. And he wasn't exaggerating. The first half of the $1.4 million goes to the engineer Charles Coe. I think that's how you pronounce it.
K-A-O.
Coe. I don't like that pronunciation. they said specifically for groundbreaking achievements concerning the transmission of light and fibers for optical communication. In fact, he's widely regarded as the father of fiber optic communications. Even though in the mid '60s, when he came on the scene, he didn't invent this. Fiber optics already existed, but their applications were very, very local. They would only work for 20 meters or so, and then the light would just attenuate into nothingness. So they did have certain applications, especially medical applications, but for long-distance communications, they were worthless, really. And the common wisdom at the time was that imperfections in the glass were scattering the light. But this guy realized that this wasn't a manufacturing problem. It was that the glass was not pure enough, and it was his idea to fuse quartz to make it a more transparent medium. And when he initially presented this paper in the late 60s, he got laughed pretty much off the stage, but because it was just so hard for people to think that he could make such a such a huge difference. And I guess, you know, he's been kind of laughing for the past 30 or 40 years. The estimate that a lot of articles like throwing around is that there's now 600 million miles of fiber optics, you know, a fiber etching the surface of the Earth. I figured that would get you somewhere between Jupiter and Saturn, or about 25,000 times around the Earth. And then if you actually shone a laser through that fiber, it would take 80 minutes to go all the way through it if it was just a straight go. And here's another interesting one. That number is increasing by thousands of kilometers every hour. So you couldn't even outrace it with a car. I mean, it's just expanding by such a huge amount.
And the basic concept, just to for a little bit background of a fiber optic, is that it is basically a cable of glass that has a refractive index such that a beam of light will always bounce back and stay inside the glass. It'll never get out. It'll never bounce outside of it. Right?
But yeah, it's total internal reflection. But you know, it would eventually attenuate a bit. You gotta add stuff to make sure that doesn't happen. But occasionally, with the angle, it would hit the edge, the outer part of the fiber at such an angle that some of it would leak out. And there's ways around that. But yeah, that's essentially it. I'll mention this in my blog in more detail. But if you want to see what some of the cutting edge fiber optic stuff that's going on now, just do a search on photonic crystal fibers. They're pretty amazing, and they're kind of like just the next huge thing. Actually, they've been around since the year 2000, and it's a really one of the most active fields of optics research. Is like this next generation of type of fiber, much more adaptable than just the regular fiber. Now, much of that information that's coursing through the fiber are digital images, notably porn, of course. But that leads to the second half of the Nobel Prize for Physics, and that half was awarded to two people. Willard Boyle and George Smith, they worked at the prolific Bell Labs in 1969, and they won it for the invention of an imaging semiconductor circuit, the CCD sensor. You've probably heard about CCDs.
Oh, yeah.
It stands for charge – yeah, Evan, I'm sure you have – charge-coupled device. If you've ever taken a digital picture, then you've held one in your hands. They essentially take photons of light and turn them into digital images that are stored, photoshopped, uploaded, printed, auto-eradicated, and all the other things that we do to them. In September 69, these guys were just working on a new type of electronic memory. Dr. Smith said that in my first notebook entry, I fully described how we would use it as an imaging device as well. So they were working specifically on a picture phone, but can you believe that project was canceled? And then they moved on to other projects, but the CCD genie had been released, and he's been a very very busy little genie. If you're interested, the CCD works because of the photoelectric effect, which I didn't realize this. This was discovered by Heinrich Hertz, but later first fully explained by Albert Einstein, and that's why he won his Nobel Prize in the 1920s for the photoelectric effect. He never actually won a Nobel for relativity. Can you believe that?
That's right.
It was still, even in the early 20s, people were still trying to get their heads around relativity. But they felt they had to give him something. And I mean, not that the photoelectric effect wasn't worth it. It's truly a fascinating phenomenon. And it was extremely important as well.
I wonder if Heinrich Hertz ever went by the name Heine.
Hi.
You're Heine Hertz. Heine Hertz.
His name Hertz is well represented, though.
Megahertz,
blah, blah, blah. But the photoelectric effect, basically when you shine light on pretty much on metal or gas or liquids or anything, if it's done properly, then it kicks out an electron. If the light energy is above a certain threshold, and studying this effect, obviously you could apply that knowledge for CCDs, but studying the photoelectric effect was one of the key events that led to our understanding of the quantum nature of light and electrons, and helped scientists conceptualize the wave-particle duality. So this is really an important idea that Hertz and Einstein developed.
But most importantly, I wouldn't have my digital camera if it wasn't for these guys.
Yeah, right. On that note, Steve, when you have your digital camera, and what's going on then is that you open the shutter and the lens focuses the light onto the CCD. This light hits the CCD, knocks out electrons, which then gather into these small wells called capacitors, which are – each capacitor is essentially one pixel of the resulting image. The brighter the light at each of these capacitors, the greater the charge that it holds. So then eventually when the shutter does shut – the charges are added up, and they use that information to recreate the original scene digitally. Mm. So clearly a huge, huge thing that these guys that developed. And how many digital cameras are there? It's so weird in our lifetimes. There's a bunch of examples, but I think cameras are one of the big ones where Steve and Jay and Evan growing up, you know, we had our cheesy little cameras. And it wasn't that long ago where regular film cameras were it. They were, you know, 99.999% of the market. And now it's just amazing to see that such a huge change. When my daughter was born in 98, I remember I was at work, I was going to the hospital, and I didn't have a camera on me, and I borrowed a digital camera from my friend at work. It was like the first generation. I had never even held one before. And I took a bunch of pictures, and it was really cool. It was a little difficult to go through the whole process because they weren't very sophisticated. But in just that time, my daughter's 11 now, and now that's all. If you're just a regular picture taker and not a professional, you will. I think everyone goes for digital unless you're really a high-end photographer.
It's so ubiquitous. It's on your cell phone. It's everywhere.
Right.
Or if you're an ironic hipster, they like the film still.
Right.
Well, yes, if you're smoking cigarettes in
vacuum
Paris
tubes
and you're wearing a beret
and
eating
and
cheese.
Momo, Diana camera, yeah.
And it's not just CCDs and cameras. That CCDs are looking at Mars, and they're on the Hubble telescope, and their medical applications. There's just so many applications for these things. So a very important invention, and well worth the half of $1.4 million.
Absolutely. Well, it's always fun to talk about the Nobel Prizes.
Yeah.
And of course, the Ig Nobels were also just announced. Yeah. That's a whole other topic.
Oh, we should do that next week.
I mean, yeah, maybe next week. The next news item is about a new fossil hominid, Ardipithecus.
Jay, you've been waiting all night for that.
Ardipithecus ramidus. This guy has hit ramidus. The news like a storm. So this is a one of those occasionally we discover just a beautiful fossil or a set of fossils that rewrites the details of our of evolutionary history. This is a publication that. Was 17 years in the making. Scientists led by Tim White, who is a paleoanthropologist, but that's actually done a lot of important work in this area, have been looking at fossil specimens from 36 different individuals, including one very well-preserved individual.
That's huge, 36.
Yeah, men, women, and children from the Awash region of Ethiopia that together form a new fossil human ancestor species, Ardipithecus ramidus. This is now the oldest fossil that's definitely on the human line.
Prompting many headlines declaring the missing link to be found.
Oh,
right.
Yes.
Right, right. it's always frustrating reading the news reports of things like this because they just never get it quite right. It ranges from almost, but not quite right to, like, painful.
Horrific.
Yeah, just horrific. But in any case, the very interesting, so we learned a lot about, about human evolution from this species. So previously, the oldest members of the hominid line were the Australopithecus species, such as Lucy. So remember, everyone remembers Lucy. Was
Lucy!
The best preserved, most probably most famous hominid fossil. Australopithecus dates...
Which is what Lucy was, Australopithecus.
Yeah, right. To about 4 million years old. These fossils are 4.4 million. So this is pushing back the human story 0.4 million years.
10%.
We probably branched off from... Our common ancestors with chimpanzees about 6 to 7 million years ago. So we still have about a 1.6 million year gap where we don't have any fossils.
Yeah,
and we also do not have the common ancestor between humans and chimps. So that's a real quote unquote missing link that that will be a news story when we find a candidate for something that's very close to the common ancestor between humans and chimps. Interestingly, Ardipithecus has some interesting features. First of all, it was fully bipedal. It walked completely erect. However, it probably lived in a wooded area. It still had adaptations for climbing through the trees. Probably spent some of its time in the trees, some of its time walking around. It may have also been walking, through the trees, like walking on one branch while holding on to another. That alters our previous conception that humans evolved bipedalism on the savanna. So this now rewrites our thinking about how humans evolved bipedalism.
So they could tell by looking at the fossil, they could accurately tell that it didn't just walk or it didn't learn to walk on the savanna, but that it did that in the trees as well.
Well, it had adaptations to climbing through the trees, arboreal adaptations in terms of its grasping toes, for example. But it also had its pelvic structure, et cetera. We could say it definitely was bipedal, although it had more flat feet. It lacked arches, so it was recently adapted to bipedalism and hadn't developed some later refinements.
Like high heels.
Yeah, like an arched foot to help give us more endurance, to be able to walk longer, for example. It's basically the details of the anatomy that we could compare to other species and say, oh, yeah, that this is an arboreal adaptation or this is an adaptation to bipedalism. So that was one interesting thing. The teeth reflect that it was probably an omnivore, which in and of itself is not too surprising. Its brain capacity was about 300 to 350 cubic centimeters.
Tiny.
Tiny, very tiny, but much closer to chimps than to humans.
How big is a chimp?
Chimps are about 300. Humans can be up to 2,000.
And that's one of the reasons why we know that the common ancestor is about 6 million years ago?
It's based upon fossil evidence, but that's also the genetic evidence sort of points to that time frame. And there's some wiggle room in there. I mean, the 6 million is not necessarily a precise figure, but that's about when the branching point was. And again, it probably wasn't a clean break. If you recall previous news items, a couple of years ago, I think we talked about the fact that there may have been some genetic exchange between the human branch and the chimpanzee branch.
Hey, settle down.
For millions of years after the quote-unquote split. So these things are never clean, you know. We tell tidy little stories, but the reality is much messier. I also, you know, love these kinds of fossils like Ardipithecus because it's a beautiful transitional species, right? If you tried to come up with a creature that was, you know, half human and half chimpanzee, although that's not literally true, and I'll get to that in a second. This is the kind of thing that you would come up with. It's got a very chimp-sized brain. But it's bipedal, but it's still arboreal. I mean, it's a transitional species. It's, you know, it's neither human nor fully non-human ape. You know?
Steve, you're clearly too emotionally close to this topic. We have to move on.
It's good passion.
Another thing that's interesting is how different this species is, Ardipithecus, is from modern chimpanzees. What this brings home is how far chimpanzees have evolved in the last 6 million years, right? We should not assume that the common ancestor of humans and chimps looked more like chimps than like humans, right? Now, it is true that, you know, bipedalism was a pretty radical difference for us, but still, chimpanzees evolved knuckle-walking after the split from humans. Like, we evolved bipedalism, they evolved knuckle walking. So,
Steve, have you ever had someone ask you, well, how come there's still monkeys then?
Well, yeah, you know, that's the classic creationist nonsensical statement, you know. And we've made this point probably a dozen times just on this show, that humans did not evolve from chimps. Humans and chimps have evolved from a common ancestor. And chimps have as much evolutionary history between them and that common ancestor as we do. And Ardipithecus really brings that home. It's really not getting closer to a chimpanzee. It's getting closer to something else that was a common ancestor between humans and chimps, right? So very interesting. So that's that was, I think, one of my favorite news stories from the last week or so. And if you're interested in Ardipithecus, I saw an advertisement for a special on the Discovery Channel on Sunday at 9 p.m. So that's just the day after this episode comes out. So if you keep an eye out for that, if you want to learn
more. That's good
because
football games are pretty much done by then. So that works for me.
Right. One more quick news item, and I blogged about this on Neurologica and Science Based Medicine because, again, we got a lot of email about this. This one, again, has been in the news and has created a lot of confusion. I've written and spoken before about the prevalence of autism. And yes, it has been increasing, the prevalence of autism diagnosis. The scientific community is pretty much in unison in the conclusion that the increase in the number of diagnoses of autism in the last 20 years is mostly due to a broadening of the definition and increased surveillance, meaning we're looking for it more. And we've broadened that, we're calling more things autism. We've broadened the definition. That's clearly most, if not all, of the increase in prevalence. The data is not enough to say definitively that there isn't also a small, real increase in autism. There's no reason to think that there is, but we can't say that there isn't. All we could say is that if there is a real increase, it's very small, and the increase that we are measuring can be explained based upon these artifacts of surveillance and broadening the diagnosis. Of course, the anti-vaccine crowd is always screaming about, you know, the increase in autism and that it's an epidemic and that means that there must be an environmental cause, but they're just wrong, that's not what the data shows. There were two recent studies that came out that showed that the rate, that the prevalence of autism, and prevalence means it's a snapshot of how many people have a diagnosis at any one point in time, whereas the incidence is the number of new cases over some period of time, like over a year. The previous estimate of the prevalence of autism was about 1 in 150. The new estimate is about 1 in 100. So that's more. And there was one study published in the Journal of Pediatrics, but this was a telephone survey where they just asked parents, do you have any kids that are autistic that have ever been diagnosed? So that almost certainly overestimates the number, and that came up with a number of about 1 in 91. And there was the CDC also has some data. They have not yet published it, but they did make it public in a press release. And they found that their estimates are that, again, that the autism rates are at 1% or 100 in 10,000. About a 50% increase from the estimates from about 5 or 6 years ago. I really just wanted to make the point that this, despite the media attention this is getting, this evidence does not support the conclusion that actual true autism rates are increasing. In fact, there was a recent survey done by the National Health Service in the UK where they did a very clever thing. They looked at the prevalence of autism of various age groups. Now, you would think that if true autism rates were increasing, well, then there must be fewer percentage-wise, 50 to 60-year-olds with autism than there are 20 to 30-year-olds.
Ah, right? Cool.
Yep.
Guess what the prevalence of autism is in every single age group they looked at?
1%.
1%. The same percentage that the CDC came up with, and it's consistent across age groups. This was not a perfect study either. No study is perfect. It's when you're surveying a population, you can't count every single individual, so you figure out some way to examine a subset, and there's always choices that you make. The one major criticism that I've heard of the study, which I think has some legitimacy and probably means they underestimated the numbers a little bit, is that they did not count people who were institutionalized. Basically.
Oh.
So, but the thing is, they used the same methods across age groups. So you could think, whatever biases there were, there's no reason to think that they're different for different age groups and that they're exactly different enough to give the same number in every age group, right? That's a little bit of special pleading to say that. Mm-hmm. So this is very strong evidence, and this combines with multiple other epidemiological studies which show that the true autism rates are not increasing. When you do apply a consistent method of counting autism across different periods of time or different ages or different cohorts, you get to about the same number. So it does not appear to have been changing over time.
And David Kirby, of course, recognizes and acknowledges this data, right?
Right. David Kirby. So he wrote for – he's the journalist who's been claiming that vaccines cause autism for years. Gets it totally wrong. When I blogged about this, I made the point that Kirby, now writing for the Age of Autism website, which is an anti-vaccine website, is using this to try to raise the alarm bells about – the autism epidemic, and coyly suggesting that there's some conspiracy. Like, why is the medical community not concerned about this? As if there's some conspiracy of silence. But he doesn't acknowledge that this very data, the fact that the autism rates are increasing, the diagnosis rates, completely torpedoes the notion that thimerosal causes autism, because thimerosal exposure has plummeted since it was removed from most vaccines, but autism rates continue to increase. This is exactly what he said would 5-6 years ago. This he was saying this was not going to happen. Autism rates were going to plateau and then decrease. Now he's crowing about the fact that they're increasing as if that somehow supports his position. Totally moving the goalposts.
But he's totally off the thimerosal bandwagon by now anyway, right? I'm sure he's on to other causes, potential.
So what the anti-vaccine community has done is they were targeting the MMR vaccine based upon Wakefield's fraudulent study. Then they migrated over to thimerosal. Now that the bottom is dropping out of the thimerosal hypothesis, they said, well, it's just other toxins in vaccines. It's aluminum. It's the fake toxins that aren't really there, or it's just non-specific toxins. It's just the overall toxicity of the vaccines. Now they're moving on to the Hep B vaccine and another component of some vaccines called squalene, which is actually a naturally occurring compound. I don't have enough time to get into those two things this week, but that's their next target. But again, that's just the moving goalpost. When one hypothesis collapses, they move on to something else in vaccines. But it always has to be about the vaccines, right? No matter what their hypothesis, it's always the vaccines. That's the
big
key.
Pharma.
Right. And there's, of course, there's the big pharma you know, medical establishment government conspiracy, because I don't know why we like to kill kids, apparently.
Make a lot of money doing it.
Not as much right. money as they're making doing it, you know, I'll tell yeah, you that. They're making a lot of money selling yeah, quackery, right. that's for sure.
Talk about irony. It's yeah. unbelievable.
They're actually guilty of the thing they're falsely accusing us of being guilty of. So that I wanted to just clear that up, since that has been very prominent in the news this week. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Dan Hooper. Dan, welcome to the Skeptics Guide.
Happy to be here.
And Dr. Hooper is an associate scientist in the Theoretical Astrophysics Group at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory and an assistant professor in the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. And the reason why we are interviewing Dan this week is to talk about dark matter, specifically a recent news item of interest. But first, Dan, can you tell our audience what is dark matter and why do we think it exists?
Well, we just use the word dark matter to classify all of the mass out there in the universe that we haven't detected yet and frankly don't know the nature of at this point. We hope that might change someday, but all we know right now is that there's an awful lot of mass out there in the universe that isn't made of things like stars and gas and dust and other sort of mundane material. We think it's there, or rather confident that it's there, because, for example, when we look at how galaxies rotate, it's pretty clear that there's more gravity in those galaxies than can be accounted for by the stars and other stuff. Similarly, when we look at the clusters of galaxies, these bigger objects, sure enough, they weigh a lot more than you can account for with a normal matter. And even when you look at the radiation left over from the Big Bang, it's pretty clear from that, the patterns in that radiation, that there were deep bodies of gravity in those first hundreds of thousands of years where the structures that would eventually form galaxies and et cetera were already there at that time. So we have lots of different observational handles that all lead us to the conclusion that most of the matter in our universe is dark or dark matter.
But so what it sounds like is that what is not controversial and what we could say for sure based upon multiple independent lines of evidence, is that there's more gravity in the universe than can be accounted for by visible, ordinary matter, correct?
Right, by quite a margin, yes.
My understanding is that the controversy, and you could let me know how much of a controversy it really is whether or not this extra gravity is coming from dark matter, some substance producing the gravity, or whether or not it's just a misunderstanding on our part of gravity itself. Perhaps regular matter creates more gravity than we thought.
This has been a very popular notion for a long time, and there have been a lot of very good scientists who have put a lot of effort into exploring the possibility that maybe we just don't understand gravity and there isn't any dark matter. So the first attempts to do this were done by a scientist named Milgram back in 1983 with an idea he had called MOND, which stands for Modified Newtonian Dynamics. And so his basic idea was that one of the first laws you learn in physics, F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration, according to Milgram, was only true for sufficiently large accelerations. If you got to very, very small accelerations, this law would have to be changed in such a way that you would mimic the effect of extra gravity. So you could have galaxies that don't have dark matter but still rotate the way that we see them. And this was very popular for a long time, and people worked on it a lot of different ways. It faced a couple of challenges, however. One of those challenges is that nobody ever formulated a MOND theory that was consistent with Einstein's theory of relativity. Mm-hmm. People tried to do that for decades. People have succeeded in doing that once now. A fellow by the name of Jacob Bekenstein managed to do it a few years ago. But then there's another, perhaps more serious problem, which is an observational one, which is that some of these objects we see clearly show the ordinary stars and the dust and gas to be in one place in a system while the gravity is centered somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And objects like this, there's just no kind of modified gravity theory that can explain that. The most striking example is something called the bullet cluster. So the bullet cluster is actually two clusters of galaxies, and these objects passed through each other about 100 million years ago. And when they did that, the gas in the clusters collided and slowed down, while the dark matter just kept going. So the dark matter now is far to the left or right of these objects, while the gas is all stuck in the middle. And you can tell the dark matter is there by its gravity, and there just isn't, you know, any visible matter there to account for it. So as far as I'm concerned, there's never been a modified gravity theory proposed that can explain this observation, whereas dark matter can explain it very easily.
But yet relativity could be tweaked to say that it does exist. Does that, what does that mean, though? How could relativity agree with it, but clearly there's evidence that at the very least Mond can't be a big player at all, because clearly there's some dark matter there. So how do you square yourself with the relativity?
So Einstein's theory of relativity alone just gives you the normal F equals ma. It doesn't give you Mond. But people have worked very hard to find a way to change Einstein's theory in a way that keeps the basic, the fundamental principles of relativity intact, but mm-hmm. still get this modified gravity at the scale of galaxies. And the only person to do this in a way that is, you know, consistent with most of the observations is this Jacob Bekenstein fellow. And he's a very, very important figure in this sort of physics. But even in his scenario, though, even though he has a Mond theory that is consistent with the basic principles of Einstein's work, even that can't explain things like these dynamical systems like the bullet cluster and, you know, bodies like that.
And that was my understanding, that the bullet cluster evidence was the biggest smoking gun, if you will, for dark matter, because the dark matter wasn't where the matter was.
That's right.
Right. So, but although in reading about that recently, it made it sound like the stars and the gas kind of separated from each other a little bit too. Right. So the stars sort of in these clusters passed through each other more, and really it was the gas that crashed into each other and slowed down the most.
That's right. So stars, you know, we might be surprised to learn this, but there aren't that many stars in galaxies. And if you have two galaxies collide into one another, very, very few stars will collide with anything. They'll basically pass through each other unimpeded. The gas is different. The gas is where you get the friction. That's where things collide.
So, but what you're saying is that the dark matter and therefore the gravity was separated from the stars enough itself that it was asymmetrical, right? So that there has to be something moving that gravity away from the both the dust and the stars. It can't just be that the gravity from those stars is different.
Well, as it turns out, in the scale of clusters, the stars are almost entirely irrelevant. They're a very, very small fraction of the mass.
I see.
And even in modified gravity theories, they don't have nearly the kind of gravitational strength it would take to explain these observations.
I see. So it's really the dust and gas that has most of the visible matter.
It's basically gas and dark matter. Those are the two elements
players.
At hand.
I see.
Yeah, two players.
Okay.
Steve, I think we should probably now get into the new evidence then with the dark matter, and then try to.
Yeah, I mean the new evidence is extremely interesting, and I can certainly see why they would bring up Mond in this. So, do you want to summarize it? This is a recent study looking at 28, I guess, galaxies and looking at the distribution of gravity and matter in these galaxies.
So the basic principle that this paper is trying to point out is that in the subset of galaxies that they look at, there's a couple of dozen galaxies they look at, that they all have basically the same density of baryonic material or stars and gas, things like this, in their inner regions, regardless of how bright they are. Or, you know, when we look at these objects, we infer how much dark matter we think is there, but that always seems to trace how much ordinary matter is there, according to this paper.
Mm-hmm.
We're a little surprised by that. That's not what you would normally expect. You would expect some objects to have a lot of dark matter and very little stars or gas, and you'd find other objects that have lots of gas and stars and not a lot of dark matter. There's no reason they necessarily have to trace each other in this way, although you'd expect them to trace each other to some extent, because where there's dark matter, there's gravity that could pull stars into it, for example, or vice versa. But still, it's a little surprising that there's such a tight relationship.
Because you would expect that just over time, collisions like what happened to the Bullock clusters would happen. And, for example, there's mechanisms by which some galaxies would have lost their dark matter, if you will, or gathered more dark matter. So there should be, right, just the historical contingency in the life of these galaxies may have produced some difference. So why is it all the same? So if you're saying that the lines of evidence are pretty solid that dark matter exists, then what do you think? What's your hypothesis? Is it just sampling error? Do we have to look at 100 or 200 more galaxies? Or is there something going on we're not aware of?
Well, I'm not exactly sure that I know with any confidence what exactly the problem, if anything, is here. But there are a few things that I could put out there as possible problems. One is that we're just looking at a few dozen galaxies here, and it's not a huge sample. And it's also possible that your sample is biased because you're looking at those galaxies you happen to be able to study well, namely the brightest ones. So that maybe isn't the most reliable sample or unbiased sample like you'd like. Another thing is that some of these measurements that tell you how much material in the form of gas there is in these objects, it's done by measuring the light from atomic hydrogen, you know, hydrogen in the form of single atoms. But we know that by looking at these objects, that in the highest density objects, you have much more molecular hydrogen, you know, hydrogen that's actually in the form of H2 molecules as opposed to separated atoms. And so that wouldn't show up in this sort of study. So it's possible that this relationship isn't real at all, only that you're only noticing a small fraction of the gas in these objects. And if you really measured all the gas, the relationship would be broken. And then on top of that, another thing I might possibly worry about here is just the matter of what kind of relationship you would expect between the dark matter profile shape and the baryonic density, the star and gas density. In this paper, they don't do any comparisons of their data to any models or theories or hypotheses, so it's kind of hard to make a conclusion. Their plot shows that, yes, the densities seem pretty similar over a lot of different brightnesses, but I don't know how much I should expect it to vary from that. And I would like to know that before I can make any strong statements about if I think this is proof of any kind of new dynamics or anything else going on.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not unreasonable to assume that galaxies may form in similar ways. And if you're looking at similar galaxies or ones with a similar history, it's not necessarily a surprise that their mass distribution is also similar. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And when you build it, when you have a telescope and you have some special tool, and it's good at looking at some specific kind of galaxy, you'll tend to collect, you know, observations of that kind of galaxy. And yeah, they'll be similar because you're biased in a way that leads you to look at that kind of similar object. You know, when you have a hammer and you want to use it, yeah, you go around looking for things that look like nails. It's the same thing here.
So there may have been a sampling bias, and by the way they chose. So how did they choose which galaxies to assess, I guess is the question.
Yeah, I actually don't know the answer
to
that.
But that was one of the things we might need to explore to say, was there some kind of systematic selection bias so that they chose similar galaxies because they were looking at the ones that they could do the kind of analysis they were doing, right?
One thing about this article is it's a page and a half long. So the details of how they come to their conclusions are largely not included. This is a journal that doesn't allow for much elucidation of these points. So it's a very, very brief summary of a conclusion.
So it sounds like we have, on the one hand, we have pretty solid evidence that something like dark matter needs to exist in order to explain our observations. And then now we have this one study, which is a very brief report of a limited observation that may be interesting, but certainly nothing that's going to really shake our confidence in dark matter.
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. I don't think it's going to change very many people's opinion on this issue. I think the vast majority of the astrophysics and cosmology communities are going to remain confident in their conviction that dark matter exists.
So at this point in time, we don't really have a theory as to what dark matter actually is, right? Just in terms of particle physics, just our standard model of what the stuff of the universe is. There is no place where you say that's what dark matter is, right? And if that's correct, do you have a hunch at this point as to what it might be?
Well, when people say we don't have a theory, I always like to pick a fight with them. The problem isn't that we don't have a theory. The problem is that we have far too many.
Huh. Machos and wimps?
Well, machos probably aren't viable anymore. When I say machos, I mean things like black holes and neutron stars. And we have ways of looking for these, and it turns out there just aren't that many of them. So they aren't the dark matter.
Yeah, the wimps, I think, are more viable, the weakly interacting massive particles.
That's right. And a wimp isn't a specific kind of particle. It's a class. Any right. kind of particle that right. doesn't interact very much and is pretty heavy and slow-moving, that's what we call a wimp. There are some types of wimps that particle physicists have come up with. One is a supersymmetric particle called a neutralino, and I won't go into exactly what that means, but it's a theory called supersymmetry that the particle physicists like because it solves a lot of different problems. It also happens to predict the existence of a particle that would look a lot like dark matter in it. So people find that pretty attractive. Another particle theory that the physicists like predicts the existence of a particle called an axion that could also make up the dark matter of our universe. People have also written papers about particles moving through extra dimensions of space, maybe making right. up the dark matter, and many, many, many other ideas. I could make a list of 40 or 50 off the top of my head if I had to, probably. But, there's no shortage of hypotheses. The thing we're short of right now are experimental tools that can discriminate between these different candidates.
Is this something that might emerge out of one of the particle accelerators? Is that a possibility?
Absolutely. I'm especially enthusiastic about the Large Hadron Collider in this respect. There's a reasonably good chance that if wimps do make up the dark matter, that we'll be able to manufacture dark matter particles for the first time and study them in the laboratory. The reason these experiments work is it all comes down to Einstein's E=mc² law, which says energy and mass can kind of be exchanged for one another. So if you want to create heavy particles, namely particles with a lot of mass, you need to have a lot of energy at one place at one time. And the best way we have to do that is to smash beams of particles together and hope things like, dark matter particles, for example, come out.
Would the dark matter particle even interact with a bubble chamber? How would we even know that it's even was there?
So the way you would know it's there is you know how much energy comes in from various directions.
And
you
see
some of it come out. But the amount that comes out or the momentum that comes out is less than what came in.
Okay.
You look for missing energy or missing momentum.
Yeah, there'll be some missing energy / mass, and we'll say, well, that whatever's missing, that's dark matter.
It might be anyway. And there are ways to study the detailed distributions of that missing energy and try to tell it apart from, say, ordinary particles like neutrinos that you also don't detect.
And weakly interacting is not interacting, right? So is it possible we could figure out some way to detect it? Like I know, as you mentioned, neutrinos, those are also fairly weakly interacting particles, right? And we have these deep underground pools of water that we use to detect them. Isn't that correct?
That's right. So as far as we're aware, there are four fundamental forces in nature. One is gravity. One is electromagnetism. And then there's the strong and weak nuclear forces. So the reason that, for example, my hand won't pass through the wall if I push it up against it is because my hand's full of charged atoms, and so is the wall, and the electromagnetic force repels them from each other. So my hand won't travel through the wall because of electromagnetism. But if you had a different kind of particle that didn't have electric charge, it won't feel electromagnetism, and in principle, it could walk right through the wall. For that matter, a particle like this could go straight through the Earth without knowing it's there. Neutrinos do this, for example, and dark matter could also do this. But even that weak force, which almost never comes into play, still occasionally does. And you can build a detector and put it in a deep underground mine, for example, and just hope that an occasional dark matter particle will come along and bounce off it and record that sort of event. And lots of experimenters are underway trying to do this right now. That's certainly one of the promising things. or promising ways we have to hope to discover dark matter directly.
Right. So either it may spin out of a particle accelerator, or we may build a huge detector that may find them. Those are the two ways to directly detect it at this point.
Well, these underground detectors aren't necessarily huge. The world leader in this game right now is called CDMS, and they're up in an old abandoned iron mine in northern Minnesota, and I think their detector is something like 5 kilograms. It's a very small, ultra-cold target that they try to identify WMPs with.
Dan, is there anything else that you would like to talk about or anything you want us to plug?
Well, if you want to learn more about dark matter, or for that matter, about dark energy, I wrote a book for non-scientists about that called Dark Cosmos, and it came out of Smithsonian HarperCollins a couple of years ago, so I encourage you to read that if you are interested.
Excellent.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us and explaining everything about dark matter to us. We really appreciate it.
Sure. I'd be happy to talk to you again sometime if you're interested.
Absolutely.
I feel much better now. Dark matter. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So this past weekend was Tam London, and throughout the weekend, I joined a co-host, Neil Denny, of the Little Atoms radio show and podcast, in interviewing as many guests and speakers as we could. All we did was grab people, drag them into a small closet, and spend a few minutes joking around with them, talking to them about their experiences at Tam. So here's the first of those interviews. You can hear the rest in upcoming episodes of The Skeptic's Guide. You can also hear them on the Little Atoms podcast. And you can hear slightly less censored versions over on Skeptic, because sometimes we got a little off topic and a little bawdy. So here's the first one. This is Neil and I interviewing physicist Professor Brian Cox.
Hello, what's your name?
I'm Brian Cox, and I'm a professor of particle physics. I work at CERN in Geneva and make the odd tele program.
So it's very kind of you to take a break from the giant Bond villain-esque base underneath the countryside of Switzerland, where new physicists are basically plotting to destroy the world, or the universe even. So why have you come to town?
Well, to give the world an extra week. Because if I'm not there, then obviously the process of destroying the universe is slowed. So, you know, I just give everyone an extra week.
It's very kind of you. Are you asking for any money, any kind of ransom?
No, we just think that really the human race has run its course. Irrationality has triumphed over rationality. It's the ultimate benevolent skeptic gesture to just take the whole lot out, I think. Really, that's my view.
I agree, because, you know, a lot of religions seem to have the market cornered on crazy people trying to kill everyone, so...
Well, that's it, and I think it's time for skeptics to step forward. And so, really, that's what we're doing. But how's that?
In the talk yesterday, you mentioned everybody will know that when the Giant Hadron Collider was switched on, there was a problem, and it's been being about the men in to fix it basically for the last few months. So what position are we at now with it?
Oh, it's fixed now. It's got a new protection system, and this is serious now. This is a serious bit. It's got a new protection system in that, so we have the same fault again, then it shouldn't damage anything, and it will. We've already last weekend, actually, so it's the end of September, we've tested all the injection lines, which means all the particles have come to the door of the LHC. It'll be cold in about a week from now, so sort of the mid-October. That's right, isn't it? That's a week from now, isn't it? What month is it? do you trust me?
So where am I?
And then we hope to have collisions, which is real data, before Christmas.
When do you think you'll be able to start interpreting the data?
Well, immediately. I mean, everyone's been waiting for a decade or more for this stuff. So there'll be people crawling all over it. And you can do technical measurements now. So things like the number of electrically charged particles in the collisions, things like that. Because even though it's at a lower energy, we run at half energy to start with now to sort of ramp up. That's still 3.5 times the energy of anything we've had before. So you can do these technical, they won't be headline measurements, but they're going to be interesting to particle physicists. Big ones. We're going to run for a year now, if all goes well. So we will have interesting results, I think, by the end of next year.
Fantastic.
And a small black hole somewhere thereafter?
Well, you know, I mean, if you can make those things, quite honestly, then you'll be making them all the time. They'll be in as we know, they'll be in cosmic ray collisions anyway, raining down on us. And yeah, we'll make them if they're there. It's, the trick is seeing them. They are actually really, really, that signature is difficult to see. So, but we'll be looking for it. But in all seriousness, it's more difficult to tip the universe over the edge than just building a big pipe underneath Geneva. You've got, you know, it's quite robust, the universe, believe it or not. It'll resist our attempts to break it. Not that we are attempting to break it.
It would be the irony when it's existed for billions of years and then humans come along and just a couple thousand manage to kill it all.
Well, yeah.
That's how you'll discover it started, you see. That's
no, don't worry.
Hopefully we'll make it to Christmas then. So, thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Let's do it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we'll see if Rebecca can perform sleep-deprived.
I'm so tired.
Item number one. For the first time, scientists have created a device that allows for direct brain-to-brain information transfer without any intermediary medium. Item number two, doctors report a case of a man whose skull has grown back after a large section has been removed years earlier. And item number three, scientists have developed a vaccine against cocaine that reduces drug use in over a third of those treated. Bob, go first.
Wow. What orifice did you pull these out of?
Just shut up.
Don't you tell me to shut
up. Direct brain-to-brain information transfer. What the hell? What kind of information are you talking about? If they can have people control basic stuff like cursors going up and down, then maybe they can just extending that idea and somehow. All right, so skull growing back after a large section removed years earlier. Wow, bone growing back like that. I don't know what to make of that one either. Let's see. This will be the third one, shall we? vaccine against cocaine. That reduces drug use in over a third of those treated. A vaccine? I can't think of anything that would help me decide on any of this. It's really pissing me off, so I'm just going to have to really just totally guess on this one. Brain-to-brain transfer. I could see some... the skull one. All right, maybe. I guess I can kind of see that.
Please, Bob. Please just make a decision.
I'm sorry. All right, I'll...
Please, God.
The brain to brain. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Rebecca.
I agree.
Okay, short and sweet. Jay.
So what we got here is for the.
I hate you guys.
We love it.
It helps me think. It helps me think about them. Oh God! All right.
Do what Rebecca did—a brain to brain thing.
I don't know about that. Brain to brain information transfer. I mean, this better not be something lame, Steve. Like freaking. Morse code or some shit like that.
Jay, don't expect, 3D high-definition movies.
I know, but that's so wide open. Okay, for the first time, these scientists have created a device that do brain-to-brain information transfer. That could be anything. It could be any kind of transfer of information, which is so wide open, I can't even...
I know, but even something little would be cool.
And without any intermediary medium. That's vague. What are you talking about? No electrical wires, no nothing? Like, what are they – how are they doing?
Ether.
Are they bonking heads?
In other words, the information is going directly from one brain to another. That doesn't mean that they're not using some device, right? It just means it's not like it's translating it into pictures and then pictures back into information. You know what I mean?
Yeah, look, you wrote it. Don't get mad at me. So anyway, the next one is doctors report a case of a man whose skull has grown back after a large section has been removed. I absolutely believe that one. Why not? Bone grows back all the time. It sounds perfectly chronic.
Except when it doesn't.
Scientists have developed a vaccine against cocaine. Now, how do you – you can vaccinate against cocaine. It reduces the cocaine user's drug use, meaning that it makes them less addicted to cocaine. I think that's plausible. I'm telling you, I think that that one is the fake, but I'm going to pick the brain-to-brain transfer. As the fake.
Okay. Evan?
Yeah, well, starting with number three, the vaccine against cocaine. I don't quite understand how that's possible, but that doesn't mean it's not true. And then the second one regarding to the part of the skull that grew back after a large section was removed, sure, absolutely. There's nothing implausible there. However, the brain-to-brain information transfer, I don't see a way that's possible. But that doesn't mean it's not true, but I'm having a problem with that one since the get-go. So I'll say brain-to-brain is fiction.
All right. So you all choose number one, the brain-to-brain transfer. So we'll take these in reverse order. Item number three, scientists have developed a vaccine against cocaine that reduces drug use in over a third of those treated. And that one is science.
Okay. I require further explanation.
Yay, cocaine.
Well, you see, they vaccinate people with a vaccine to cocaine.
With thimerosal.
They develop antibodies to the cocaine, which inactivates it, so they don't get the high from the cocaine. What they found is in about 38% of the patients, in the subjects, they developed a good antibody response. And in those people who developed a good antibody response, they had reduced use of cocaine when they were, you know, surveying, they were basically checking their urine for cocaine. They had less use than their baseline and then the others. Those who did not develop a high antibody titer did not have any measurable effect.
Interesting.
So does this mean, is that possible in all drugs then? I mean, is this
or tobacco?
The concept?
No, it's not all drugs. I mean, it has to be, it's actually challenging to get an immune response to a small molecule. That's where the trick is. And the bigger the molecule, the easier it is to get the immune system to make antibodies against it. For smaller molecules, you need to combine it with something, right? You need to hook it up to a protein or something so that that's what activates the immune system, but the molecule is there to give it the specificity. Does that make sense? So that what they need to do now in order to make this more useful is to figure out how to get more of an immune response out of more people, because that seemed to be the limiting factor.
Right.
Let's go on to the second one. Doctors report a case of a man whose skull has grown back after a large section has been removed years earlier. And that one is...
science.
Also science.
Mm.
That one's
yay.
Science. Yay.
Basically, the front, like, third of his skull was removed and replaced with a metal plate. And when they recently removed the metal plate, they found that the bone had grown in underneath it and had essentially covered the area back over. So these cases are occasionally known to occur, but they're quite rare. And what was most unusual is his age. Usually when this occurs, it's in children, you know, because children, their bones are still growing, so it's just more likely that this kind of thing would happen. It's much less common in fully grown adults. But there's a few documented cases, and this is not one. All of this means that for the first time, scientists have created a device that allows for direct brain-to-brain information transfer without any intermediary medium is fiction.
How fiction?
However, the press release for this story said almost what I just said. To be fair, I added the bit about without any intermediary medium.
Yeah.
But I didn't really have to do that. I think the press release was totally misleading. What these researchers did, and Bob, you're right, this is building on research of, you know, brain interfaces, controlling cursors and robots.
Yeah.
So they were trying to figure out, well, can we, instead of hooking up, you know, a person's brain to a computer, can we just hook it up to somebody else and transfer information directly, person to person, you know, thought transfer? But what they did was, when I read the description of what they actually did, I'm like, this isn't direct brain-to-brain information transfer. This is totally misleading. They attached an EEG amplifier, right, to the first person, right, to read their brain waves. And then that would generate a signal, a binary signal. The person would would imagine moving their left arm, which would create a zero, or their right arm, which would create a one, right? And therefore, they could create a binary signal by, you know, again, imagining they were using the left arm for zeros or right arm for one. And then that would go to a PC, which would generate would flash an LED lamp in two different frequencies based upon...
right, left or right.
Left or right. the person couldn't really perceive the flashing LED, but their visual cortex would respond to it. And then they also had an EEG amplifier on them that would record the activity in their visual cortex in response to the flashing LEDs.
What?
Yeah, right. That's not direct brain-to-brain. There's an intermediary there. Yeah. It's the one guy's brain is activating the LEDs, and which is activating the other guy's brain. Sorry.
Right.
Fail.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that's pretty lame.
It really was lame. And the way they tried to contrive this to say this was the first direct person-to-person community is BS. Sorry. I don't buy that at all. And this is their own press release, so I don't think it's like they're being misquoted by someone.
Right.
This is I don't know what to think of things like this. I don't know if this was just all in, you know, like the PR department of this university and not the researchers themselves. I mean, I think we could, you know, usually give the researchers the benefit of the doubt. And this is just some idiot PR person at the University of Southampton who thought that they could finagle, you know, this story into making it sound like thought transfer from person to person to get a sexy press release. But it's completely misrepresenting what they actually did.
So you're saying we don't have Ghost in the Machine technology, that show where they basically think whatever they think the other people that's on their line would hear what they were thinking. That's how they communicated surreptitiously. So we don't have that yet.
No. But this is not implausible that, you know, again, so we were at the point where we can read the electrical activity of someone's brain so that we could differentiate between different gross brain states, right?
Aren't all brain states gross?
Meaning not in a lot of fine detail, but like things like moving your left arm versus moving your right arm, right? So so we've done that much, right? And that's enough to move a cursor around a computer or to even for a monkey to operate a robotic arm
and to
feed themselves. Very impressive. But there seems to be a PR race going on in this area of research.
Right.
Where
the last one was lame, too. Wasn't there another lame one a few months ago?
Yeah, there was. Mm-hmm. I think Honda, it was announcing they were in the game and trying to make it seem like they were the first ones to do something. But really, again, it was crude. They hadn't even gone as far as other research that had already gone. But there's no reason why you couldn't then take that signal and then, you know, directly affect someone else's brain through electrical or magnetic signals. What that would do is not clear. I mean, could we affect it in a way that that person could perceive something discrete and do something with that information? Forget about like sending an image, like you thinking of an elephant and the other person seeing the elephant you're thinking of. You know, we're so far away from that, we can't even make predictions or extrapolations. That requires a level of sophistication that is just not on the drawing board right now.
So I totally called that one.
Yeah. But it doesn't stop the headline writers, you know. One thing they did bring up, though, which I think is very interesting, is that this might allow for a communication with people who are locked in. And that's
This
could be used for that. I mean, again, it reminds me of like Star Trek when Captain Pike was in that little wheelchair and he could blink the lights once for yes and twice for no or something. Basically, we could do that now, right? We can get somebody who's locked in who could still think but they're paralyzed from the eyes down, basically, to put an EEG on them and they could blink once or blink twice. We could do that now. And they could, in fact, they could move a cursor around and maybe even operate a robotic arm and stuff. We could do more than that.
So. Remember McCoy saying that all the technological wonders, but we haven't tapped into the brain even in two or three seconds.
Yeah, that was they blew that one.
That's pretty lame.
Yeah, I think we'll be beyond that 200 years from now.
Whatever. He's a doctor, not a neurologist.
That's true.
Damn it!
All right, Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy from last week.
Last week's Who's That Noisy. Let's replay it.
That's a perfect example of what he did last night. He sounded smooth and polished and strong and convincing. And what he was selling was snake oil. That is a completely bogus claim.
That was Dr. Charles Krauthammer.
Doctor, huh?
Yes.
Krauthammer?
Wow.
Charles Krauthammer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist, political commentator.
Pulitzer, huh? Didn't know that either.
Yes, Pulitzer. There's a lot people don't know about Charles Krauthammer. For instance, did you know he attended Harvard Medical School? And he was a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he became board certified in psychiatry. So,
Holy crap.
Yeah, so that's how he started. And then, you know, his political influences took off. He worked in the Walter Mondale campaign when Walter Mondale was running for president. Primarily the reason why I chose to feature Charles Krauthammer is because, you know, although he's generally considered a conservative, he is an intelligent design critic. He is an advocate for the scientific consensus on evolution. And he calls the religion-science controversy a false conflict. Those are his words. And he is a strong supporter of embryonic stem cell research. He is describes himself as not religious. And in 2005, he wrote several articles likening intelligent design to what he called tarted-up creationism. So he's a skeptic.
Sounds like it, yeah.
Yeah, in you know, if not by direct definition, certainly in the things he's written and spoken about. And although a lot of people identified it pretty immediately, it was Owahe, O-W-A-H-A-Y, from the message boards, who got on there first and identified him. So congratulations. Well done.
Sure it's not Owahe?
I thought it was Owahe. But
okay. I thought it was Oahu.
That's someone else. That's a different
okay, next.
Person.
What do you got for this week, Evan?
All right. This week, another voice. Let's see if we can recognize who this person is.
And these service charges, these are scams and ripoffs that the biggest banks and credit card companies are doing, and the U.S. government, the federal government, is allowing it to happen. 30 states.
Okay, there's a little taste of that. So,
huh?
Now, some of you, well, hopefully, some of you will recognize the voice. Perhaps not in the context of the content he was talking about, but think about it and give your best guess.
So, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a wonderful quote from a man named Sue. No, from a man named David Hume. David Hume was a Scottish philosopher, an economist, a historian, and a key figure in the history of Western philosophy and the Scottish Enlightenment. Hume said, "When men are most sure and arrogant, they are commonly most mistaken, giving views to passion without that proper deliberation which alone can secure them from the grossest absurdities." David Hume!
Of course, that's very appropriate because it's currently Scotchtoberfest.
Scotchtoberfest?
Yeah. That's why I picked that. Thank you.
Well, Rebecca, thanks for staying up until 4 in the morning to talk with us.
Hey, my pleasure. This is fun, guys.
How's that daylight breaking looking out your window?
Yeah, the Connecticut Drinking Skeptically group will be having Kenny Fader, an old friend of ours, talking on October 15th.
Yep. Giving his lecture on Atlantis.
On Atlantis, which is awesome. So if you're in the area, look him up online.
Guys, we really need some support from our listeners out there. We are making a call right now for software developers, for graphic designers. If you're a Flash programmer, if you know how to use Photoshop, Adobe Illustrator, any of these things and more, please let me know. I will start a thread on the forum, or you can email us from the website. We have several projects coming up. Some of them have to do with the current website. Some of them have to do with current web projects or future web projects. So please, I need your help. Anyone that has the time or inclination to help, even if you've submitted your name before and you were overlooked or your name was misplaced or lost in the volume, please just do it again. If you have the time, let me know.
So thank you for joining me again, everyone, this week.
Surely.
Glad to be here. Yep.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.